should get started. I know people are still straggling in from lunch, but we have to get out of here by 3:15 on the dot. And I'd like to get started here. And those of you expecting Ken Ward, I'm not him. My name is Don Hopi. I'm a reporter, environment reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Ken had something to do, more important, believe it or not, than this, and asked me to fill in for him. And so I am doing that, and you are at the Covering Western Coal, Surface Mining Beyond Appalachia session. And we have three very nice and good speakers for you today who will be talking. Jenny Harbine is staff attorney in Earth Justice's North Rockies office in Bozeman. Her work focuses on litigation and advocacy to address the causes of global warming, including coal mining and coal-fired power plants. The Earth Justice office in the Northern Rockies is also engaged in litigation to address effects of global warming, particularly in species such as the grizzly bear. Ms. Harbine attended law school at the University of California, Berkeley. She's an attorney. She was an attorney at a small environmental firm in San Francisco, California, before returning to Montana to work for Earth Justice in 2006. Next to her is Marion Loomis. Mr. Loomis started with the Wyoming Mining Association in 1976, and he's been executive director since 1991. He was born in Sheridan, Wyoming, raised on a ranch near Bighorn, Wyoming, and he attended the University of Wyoming and graduated with a degree in geology in 1971. He worked with the Wyoming Department of Economic Planning and Development from 71 until 1976 as an economic development geologist. Next to him is Thomas Power. Mr. Power is currently research professor and professor emeritus in the economics department at the University of Montana here, where he has been on the faculty since 1968. He served as chairman from 1976 through 2007. He specializes in natural resource and regional economic development issues, and he's written a lot of books, six of them actually. And all of this bio information is available online. We are not printing out the bios this year, so don't go to the desk and ask for bios for our speakers. We're saving some paper this year, I think. So, they're all going to have an opening statement, and afterwards we will take questions. And I might as well give you the rules now. I may have to repeat them later. You have to identify yourself and your organization before you ask the question. Please ask a question. We don't really want you to make a long statement. And working journalists first. So, first up, Jenny Harbine.
Thank you. Jenny Harbine, I'm a lawyer with Earth Justice. And I should confess at the outset that I'm not an expert on coal mining. And although I'm a lawyer, I'll try not to talk about things that I'm not an expert on. Instead, I'll just introduce briefly what Earth Justice and our clients are doing to address the impacts of coal, including impacts from coal mining. My colleagues in other offices coal, the federal and state governments that own this coal and are leasing it, to address the global warming impacts of coal combustion at the coal mining stage. The Bureau of Land Management, in particular, is poised to lease 3.7 billion tons of government coal in the Powder River Basin. Some of that's just recently been leased, and some of those leases are still pending. And additionally, there are numerous
thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. When I was asked to do this, I thought, gee whiz, I've got all this information. What am I going to cover? I feel like Madonna's latest lover. I might know what to do, but not how to make it interesting, especially to a group like this. So I thought I'd give you a real quick brief of the history of mining, the coal industry in Wyoming, and I do take a couple exceptions to what you said, Danny. I'm sorry. But we got started with our coal industry with underground mines in the 1860s with the railroads. We reached a maximum production of about 10 million tons in the 1940s before the railroads switched over to diesel. We hit a bottom of about 3 million tons then in the 1960s. And in 1969, Wyoming passed the first reclamation bill, one of the first in the country, really before our coal industry really took off. We did have some utilities that built new power plants in the 1960s and got us back up to about 7 million tons by 1970. 1970 is long before most of you were born, probably. The Congress passed the Clean Air Act, and one of the provisions of that Clean Air Act was that new power plants, could not emit more than 1.2 pounds of sulfur dioxide per million BTUs. Most eastern and midwestern coal will not meet that standard. Almost all of Wyoming coal will. So there was a real incentive to start producing coal in Wyoming. Then in 1973, the Arab oil embargo hit. As a result of that, we were going to get away from imported oil and we were going to replace it with liquid fuels and gas from coal. So there was another huge demand for leasing of Powder River Basin coal, and the oil companies leased up billions of tons of coal. There were Exxon, Mobil, Texaco, Arco, Kirby Gee, City Services all came in, leased up coal and held it, and never built any of the plants that were proposed. So in 1977, Congress passed some amendments to the Mineral Leasing Act, which said that if you're going to hold coal reserves, you have to get them into production within 10 years, or you're not going to be able to bid on any other federal lease. So all of those oil companies started developing coal mines. As a consequence of that, and the fact that our coal deposits are huge and very economic to produce, we started to produce most of the new demand of coal for the United States. I had a PowerPoint presentation and was going to show you the eastern and midwestern coals held steady at about 500 million tons through that period of and continued to hold about that level of production. But Wyoming coal grew from that 7 million tons that we mined in 1970 to 466 million tons in 2008. So we were responsible for most of the growth of the coal industry in the nation. The reserves are, as I said, are staggering. The Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana, and actually Montana actually has more coal reserves than Wyoming, is larger than any oil reserves in the world. In fact, the largest oil reserve, oil field in Saudi Arabia has about 400 quadrillion BTU. The contained in the oil field. The Powder River Basin of Wyoming, Montana has 3 trillion BTUs, a quadrillion, 3,000 quadrillion BTUs. The oil field has 400 quadrillion BTUs. And the next 22 largest oil fields in the world only have about 1,800 quadrillion BTU versus 3,000 in the Powder River Basin, Wyoming, Montana. So it's the largest source of fossil fuel energy in the world. Now, what happens in the future? Obviously, we are recognize that carbon is going to be the overriding constraint to continued development of Wyoming coal. And Jay, we have about not 3 billion, but almost 5 billion tons of coal that we have asked the federal government to lease, and none of it is to open a new mine. It's all to continue operation of existing mines. When you're mining at we dropped in production in 2009 to 430 million tons, and we're about at the same level this year. But when you're mining at that kind of a rate, you go through a lease block pretty quick. So we've got mines that, the largest is 130 million tons of coal a year. So when you're going through coal that fast, you need a new lease block to come up on a timely basis. And that's called a lease by application process, which has worked pretty well in the last 10 years, 15 years. And we would we hope to continue that just to keep our coal production going. As many of you know, and I saw numbers from the Sierra Club last night, which were accurate, Wyoming coal accounts for 40% of the nation's coal production and about 20% of the nation's electricity. So in order to continue with that, we want to see continued leases come up on a timely basis that allow us to get in and get those leases permitted. And Jay, we do have air quality rules. We have more air quality monitors in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming probably than any place in the United States concentrated. And we have very aggressively looked at ways to control dust and look at all emissions, NOx emissions, SOx, as well as particulate. And particulates have been, we can get into it more in the question and answer, but particulates have taken on a huge effort. We've worked with the state of Wyoming and EPA to develop a natural events action plan to address dust when it's generated. And as you can imagine, when you have 15 inches of moisture a year, and you strip the topsoil off of something and start digging it up, and you get 30, 40 mile an hour winds, you're going to have dust. It's not toxic dust, but it certainly is dust. And so we have initiated various plans to take immediate action when dust levels start to increase, and then long-range plans to reduce dust areas where we're going to mine and have mine. So we've now initiated efforts to start looking at our CO2 emissions from all of the equipment that is run and what we can do to try to start reducing those emissions. And we fully recognize that not only the utilities or our customers are going to have to address carbon, but the mines and are going to have to look at it also.
Okay. Next, Mr. Powell.
Since I'm an economist, I thought I would say something about the economic context in which coal mining and conversion of coal to electricity takes place. The reason for that is that in almost all discussions of coal mining, coal-fired electric generation, actually development of any energy resource or extraction of almost any mineral, there's usually considerable emphasis, especially by the mining companies, on what the expected economic impact is, usually a very positive and usually fairly large projection of employment and income impacts is put forward. The press in general, and the aim here is to pick on the press, usually picks up those assertions and carries them forward, and in the process conveys what over the last several decades I've called not economics, but folk economics, sort of popular economic assumptions about what makes our economies tick, who's the important economic players and who's not, that the stories that we as kids learn from our grandparents or kindergarten teachers that take the form of narratives, stories of livelihoods that heavily involved looking at the economy through the rearview mirror in the sense of emphasizing those types of economic activities that are associated, at least in the folk history of the area, with the original European-American settlement of the area. We interpret what's happening in the economy now and going forward heavily in terms of what was important in the past, or at least what we were taught, allowed our grandparents, great-grandparents, etc., to settle this area and prosper us. Let me give a recent example. Montana Senior Senator Max Baucus recently indicated at the end of a speech here in Montana that he might oppose allowing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to proceed to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. His argument was that he didn't think a single agency could appropriately balance the regional industrial interests that had to be balanced if a politically viable and minimally economically damaging greenhouse gas emission legislation was going to be passed. For that reason, he wanted to leave that job to Congress. In reporting on that, Environment and the Energy, a daily newsletter that's published out of Washington, D.C., explained Baucus's opposition to allowing EPA to regulate greenhouse gases in what the reporter took to be economic terms. And here's the quote. Baucus is wary of efforts to limit carbon emissions as coal mining, coal-fired electricity, and oil refineries dominate his state. So coal mining, coal-fired electricity, and oil refineries dominate the economy of Montana. It's true that Baucus may believe that. It's true that our governor and many other leaders of the state may believe that. But that's part of the folk economics. At best, it's a wild exaggeration. I think it would be more accurate to say it's patently false. Let me just toss out some numbers. In Montana, there's about 1,000 people employed in coal mining. In Montana, there's 626,000 jobs. So coal mining represents less than 0.2% of all jobs. Those jobs, of course, are paid, pay more, and tend to be full-time jobs as opposed to a lot of the jobs in Montana in rural areas, which are part-time jobs. So if the impact was stated in terms of jobs, in terms of income instead of jobs, the impact would be greater. If we look at the size of payrolls associated with coal mining jobs, instead of 0.2%, it would be 0.25%, somewhat larger. In terms of 0.25% of total personal income being received by Montanans. If we go ahead with what Environment and Energy did and combine coal mining with electric generation and petroleum refinery, there's 2,600 jobs in Montana out of 626,000. So we move all the way up to 0.4%. If we combine all of those jobs that the press was reporting dominated the Montana economy. One can take any reasonable multiplier you want and apply it to that if you believe in economic multipliers, and you're not going to get over 2% of all the jobs or all of the income in Montana being associated with that coal mining, oil refinery, coal-fired electric generation, etc. That ain't hardly economic domination by coal, oil, or coal-fired generation. Yet that's what it gets passed on. That I'm not offended because it's false or economically incorrect. What bothers me about it is that those numbers of that sort, exaggerations of that sort, play a very explicit political role in empowering certain economic actors, certain corporations, certain people in certain lines of business, saying that they're more important than other types of economic activities. That empowers them, gives them more influence over public economic policy, public energy policy, clearly seen in the greenhouse gas regulation debate, where certain industries, carbon-intensive industries, certain energy sources have been given the equivalent of a veto over certain aspects, or played a very dominant role in how the bills have gotten written and whether, in fact, they pass. The real dependence, I would argue, and the reason politicians tend to emphasize natural resource extraction, the real dependence is not that Montana citizens are dependent, especially dependent on those energy industries for jobs and income, but the government is. The government is almost always a partner in natural resource development. We heavily tax it, we collect royalties from it. It makes it easier for politicians to provide services without raising taxes on other citizens. And the net result is that our state and local governments are fairly explicitly partners in natural resource development, and they tend to easily see the interests of the state as they see them, very similar to the way that the natural resource developers do. I think that creates for very serious conflicts of interest, in the sense that the very people who are supposed to be regulating the impacts associated with natural resource development are also people who have a direct stake in the profits and revenues being generated by them. But the net result of this exaggeration of the role of certain sectors is to put them in a position to exercise far more influence over public economic and energy policy than any citizen or group of citizens has. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, all three of you. We'll start with questions. I'll kick it off with one. I'm from the East, and we have a little bit of mining in my state, not as much certainly as out here. But West Virginia, there's been some studies done there showing that there's some higher heart, respiratory disease and death rates associated with mining. Both at the mine and mine prep plant areas, not to mention the coal-fired power plants. What I was wondering was, has there been any studies done out here in the West concerning the health impacts of mining operations among populations that are in the area? And is that factored in? How does that factor into the economics that Mr. Power was talking?
We have not done any of those studies that I'm aware of, but all of our operations, with the exception of one now, are surface operations. So you're not going to find the black lung disease in surface operations that you would have in potential in underground, certainly. To my knowledge, there have not been any studies that have been done on any of the coal miners.
the reason I'm asking is that Consol Energy in Pennsylvania, the biggest coal producer there, has started a has been studying for 10 years actually the health effects of particulates not only from the coal-fired power plants but also from their coal prep plants, and surface mining operations certainly produce some dust that might be larger particulates but still might have some health effects.
I was going to make the same comment with respect to miners and health problems they have. In terms of emissions from electric power plants, after fairly long legal battles, the primary energy park, coal-fired electric generating complex in Colstrip, Montana, was required to meet close to Class 1 air quality standards. And so with the construction of the plants, fairly significant pollution controls were required. Usually it was the equivalent of what would have to be true if it was adjacent to a wilderness area or a national park. Back at that time, there were several of my graduate students were studying sulfur oxide emission impacts associated with the smelters in the state. But that information on, in terms of health, morbidity, life expectancy, etc., was also applied in the debate over what the air quality standards should be out in eastern Montana. So one of the reasons those coal-fired plants were put out there, namely to avoid strict air quality regulations on the West Coast, where the electricity was headed, Montanans didn't give the developers that privilege and imposed as strict a standard as they could. So I haven't. That I don't think that's been a big issue in Montana, but they'll let Jenny.
To answer your specific question, I'm also not aware of any studies that have been done.
Microphone.
Thanks, Jim. I'm also not aware of any specific studies that have been done, but we do know that although a smaller source than coal-fired power plants, coal mines are a significant source of nitrous oxides and fine particulate, both of which have been linked to health problems, particularly among sensitive populations. So I would not be surprised, although there are numerous sources in the Powder River Basin, including coal bed methane and coal mines that may be impacting local health. I would not be surprised if coal mines were not a contributing factor to health impacts there, pulmonary impacts.
Questions from the audience? Remember to identify yourself and your organization.
Yes. John Addison, Green Creek Report. I'm curious how much coal is required in a power plant, say for 100 megawatt hours, depending on whether it's a kind of a conventional power plant in the U.S., really efficient combined cycle, and if it's a conventional plant that's doing capture and sequestration.
Question concerns coal use?
How much coal per use?
Well, Bridger Coal is a 2,000 megawatt power plant, and it burns about 7 million tons a year. And right now, I think they've not positive of all the numbers, but I think they figure 15% or so to run their pollution control equipment. And as we, and I have seen some numbers that if we put on carbon sequestration, that could go up as high as 20-25% of your capacity would be needed to run your pollution control equipment, or all of that type of equipment. I don't know the exact numbers, but certainly the more you put on the power plant, the more energy, more coal it's going to take just to run that portion of it. So you're going to have bigger plants in the future if we do carbon capture and sequestration than we have today to get the same amount of electricity, certainly.
Questions?
Hi, my name's Randy. I'm speaking on a session tomorrow. Mary and I have a question, a couple of questions for you. Shipping coal to China. And the Chinese mined 3 billion tons last year, three times more than the U.S. Are there, what is your assessment of their future coal reserves in China? Sort of like sending coal to Newcastle would have been 150 years ago. Do the Chinese need American coal? And what does shipping costs from Wyoming to China add in terms of the price of the coal delivered over there?
I guess you all heard the question. Okay. I can't answer that. I can tell you that we may have some potential to ship coal out of the United States, but I don't think it's going to be a major market for Wyoming coal. Now, Montana's got better quality coal and they're closer to ports, so it could be an avenue for them. And we do have one operation that is getting permitted, tall feed coal, but right at Sheridan, just across the border into Wyoming, sorry, the Montana-Wyoming border. And I think the potential for that mine could be export. I'm sure they're looking at it. As far as where exports do help us, when China needs metallurgical coal and the rest of the world needs metallurgical coal and can't get enough from Australia and the conventional sources, they can use high BTU coal from the east and Midwest. And so when we see prices go way up for met coal, like they have recently, some of the coal that was going to power plants in the east and Midwest gets shipped out of the United States for metallurgical coal, and then we backfill into some of those markets. So we've seen increase in demand. Well, we're shipping coast to coast, but we're shipping coal into Pennsylvania, even West Virginia. We're shipping a little coal in. When Governor Manchin was out, and I told him that, he assured me that they were going to stop that right away. But New York, we've shipped 4 million tons into New York. So we could go quite a ways. And I figure it costs about $15 a ton to ship Wyoming coal 1,000 miles. So when we lay coal into a barge on the Mississippi and St. Louis, it's about $15 a ton. Shipping costs, our coal now is about $15 a ton, FOB the mine. So it's $30 a ton at 1,000 miles away. And if you take it to Georgia, which is another big market for Wyoming coal, it's probably closer to $25 a ton. Now, what I've heard numbers as low as $3-4 a ton once it gets on an ocean-going vessel to take it to the Pacific Rim, but I don't know those numbers. I'm not very positive on what it costs to once it gets on a ship. But certainly the cost goes way down once it gets on a ship compared to rail. Did that answer your question?
If I can add something, Peabody Coal has just proposed to construct apparently a brand new West Coast port to ship coal across the Pacific, and we recently learned of a proposal by Ombre Energy, which has apparently acquired a Powder River Basin coal mine, and you might know more about that than I do, Mary, but they plan to upgrade an existing Columbia River port.
wouldn't surprise me if some Asian nations looking forward to a setting, even some European nations who've been burning brown coal, anyways, fairly low-grade coal that have very significant emissions that are almost impossible to control, that they wouldn't be looking to trade off high transportation costs to reduce the cost of cleaning up the emissions from their plants. So that certainly has been part of what's been going on in terms of Western coal, including Montana coal, going much further east, right into the coal fields, to be mixed with coal there rather than changing the technology associated with the electric generator. So if we can ship it two-thirds of the way across the North American continent, it wouldn't surprise me if we would be putting out a boat to try to accomplish the same thing.
But we can still, at $10 a ton, and our coal's a little more than that now, but at $10 a ton, we're 50 cents per million BTU FOB demand. Eastern and Midwestern coal is around $2 FOB the mine. So if you double ours, we're still, we can ship, 1,000 miles and still be, just on cost basis, on BTU basis, much cheaper than Eastern and Midwestern coal. But you're right, a good deal of our growth was all due to they could meet these SO2 standards with our coal, and they didn't have to put on scrubbers. And by the way, Jenny, just so you know, in the 70s, we did pass amendments to our rules and regulations that set an SO2 standard six times more stringent than the federal standard. So we have to put wet scrubbers on everything and have since 1970s on our power plants. But that's only one emission. That's only sulfur dioxide. You got all the rest of it, too, that has to be addressed.
Well, it's nice that Wyoming coal benefits from environmental regulations. I'm wondering, though, whether or not what the industry here has done any type of projections concerning the potential changeover to natural gas, especially among some of the older power plants in the east. A lot of the folks in my state and in Ohio and West Virginia are seeing that as something that's coming down the line for the older plants that don't have a lot of life left. Rather than retrofit, they may be going to gas, not only because of the age of the plant, but also to meet the newer emission standards. How is that going to affect your...
Certainly natural gas is the big competitor. And I think, well, we've seen almost all of the growth in generation capacity since 2000 was natural gas. We've had some wind and some other things, but it's still really small. And there's actually more gas capacity in the country, generation capacity, than there is coal capacity. But most of it was built for peak loads. And I'm not sure how much of that could be converted over to base load if they start to displace coal. And what we see happening more, and I think if you talk to the utilities, rather than switch a coal plant, old coal plant, over, they'll just mothball and build new gas capacity that is much more efficient than trying to burn those old plants. We've already had one of our little plants shut down in Wyoming, and I would guess that across the nation we will see those old coal plants start to be they'll just shut them down and replace them with natural gas. But, yeah, it's going to be, we're going to natural gas.
Dave Levitan, freelancer from New York. Jenny, you mentioned some efforts to try to regulate at the mine side of things in terms of global warming impacts, and I guess this is related to the shipping question as well, in terms of stopping mines from exporting certain countries or to certain power plants, or I was wondering if you could just explain that a little bit more and the potential that actually happened.
technologies that would allow them to produce liquid fuels, if not from coal, from biomass or whatever else. So there's still an ongoing commitment on the part of the Department of Defense to for strategic reasons to develop technologies within this country that would allow them access to liquid fuels in case of cutoff of foreign supplies. I read something just in the last week about bids they had out for research on demonstration of other liquid fuel technologies. But Maelstrom Air Force Base was proposed as a site to try and convert Montana coal to fuels for the jet planes there, and the cost was just totally put it out of the question. So, Ms. Banner.
Anybody else? You know, most of the Western mining is done on public lands, and according to you guys today already, you're talking about, 5 billion tons of new leased land, primarily on public lands. I was wondering, is there any extra responsibility for mining companies working on those lands, either legally in terms of regulation, how they're regulated any differently, or maybe morally?
Morally? The reclamation laws would be the same regardless of whether you're on federal lands or fee lands. But the EIS and that permitting activities are certainly much, there are a lot more permitting required if you're mining federal coal. And you need to separate out lands versus reserves, because you frequently, in most cases in the Powder River Basin, you're going to have federal coal, but it's under fee-owned surface, private surface. So, but it is federal coal. But the laws that apply to it as far as reclamation would be the same in whether you're mining federal coal or fee coal.
I would add that the federal government owning the being the by far dominant owner of coal reserves within the Powder River Basin presents an opportunity, or some most in my position would say a responsibility, to examine the environmental impacts, including the global warming impacts, of offering up all of this coal and putting it into the power generation stream in a programmatic fashion. So the government could, BLM could and should, take a look at this and say, how much coal do we need? How much coal should we be mining? Where should we be mining it? And what can we do to limit the global warming and other significant environmental impacts of this coal mining? Today, BLM has not fulfilled that responsibility. Their environmental impact statements for coal mining in the Powder River Basin are largely piecemeal and examine the impacts on a mine-by-mine basis. And we and others have argued that BLM should take a step back, look at this programmatically, do some land use planning, and adopt some policies to address the global warming impacts of all of this new coal mining.
I'm Kirk Sigler. I work for a public radio affiliate out of Denver. I was hearing, I think, Marion say that you're still bracing or going for carbon regulation of some sort. I mean, at this point, with the energy bill obviously dead for now, are you
clue what it's going to look like. But it's pretty clear that as we go forward, if we're going to stay and keep producing coal, we're going to have to be addressing carbon in some fashion. So right now we're trying to get a handle on what we generate and what we can do to try to reduce the our carbon footprint. But what Congress will do is a real question. What we would like to see is a real strong commitment, and I'm sure you've heard this before, we'd like to see a real strong commitment from the government to take determine what all it's going to take to do carbon sequestration, carbon capture, carbon sequestration, and determine what the those costs are going to be and what the limitations are going to be. Because I think I don't think we understand very well what kind of the magnitude of what it would take to capture and sequester a couple billion tons of carbon dioxide a year, which is what coal generates from power plants. So, you know, and we've started looking at it in Wyoming. Montana, I think, has been looking at that also. The School of Energy Resources at Laramie is doing a lot of work on carbon capture and looking at carbon sequestration. We're going to have some demonstration projects, we hope, in the coming years here at Rock Springs. We've got a good site there for carbon sequestration. But one of my concerns is just the magnitude of what's going to take and the cost. You know, when we do carbon sequestration, you're not going to be able to just pump that liquid CO2 underground. There's something in that structure now, probably saline waters. That's going to have to be pumped out. That's going to have to be treated to make it able to be released or utilized in some fashion. I've heard that in order to sequester all of our carbon, which is 7 billion tons a year, carbon dioxide, it would take the equivalent of the entire infrastructure of the oil and gas industry for the last 100 years. I don't know if that's true or not, but just think of the magnitude of that and how daunting that is going to be. But so we would like to see get started on a future gen type of plant and determine what those costs and roadblocks are going to be, and before we start some kind of a carbon tax.
But if you're not, you're sort of, if I can ask my boss, it is, so the debate is sort of shifting. My frame of reference is more Colorado, obviously, where sequestration doesn't seem to be much of the dialogue. It seems to be natural gas. Switch the major coal-fired power plants to natural gas. But outside of Wyoming, I mean, that whole conversation has kind of gone away, right, in recent years, for carbon sequestration?
Well, no, the Future Gen is back on the table again, and there's a discussion of going forward with some kind of a project that would try to develop that technology, but it's not going very fast.
I apologize because I missed Jenny. So I'm Elsa. I'm a freelance journalist based in Los Angeles. So if you address this in your remarks, Jenny, I'm sorry. I heard you talk about places on the East Coast that you're shipping the Wyoming coal. I know that, you know, California, we're getting coal from out of state, and it's burning in a variety of other places. Where in the West Coast or in the interior West is your coal going?
Well, we've got.
We're not
shipping any to Montana, and only 2 million tons a year to Washington and 1 million tons to Oregon. So it's really pretty small. And there's a little bit going to Idaho, but Idaho is industrial coal. So really. Everything is going east and south, Colorado right now, and that the legislation they passed in Colorado might help Wyoming coal, unfortunately. But our coal, Texas, and the heartland really is where most of it goes. Texas, Oklahoma, Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. That's really the bulk of our where our coal goes. But you know, 15 million tons into Georgia, 13 into Alabama, 1 into Pennsylvania, 4 into New York. So it goes way down when we get east of the Mississippi.
That's not an accident. The West Coast doesn't want coal-fired plants. They just want the electricity from coal-fired plants. And so that's why Wyoming has huge generators that are sending electricity west, and so does Montana. That's what the Colstrip complex is all about. More feeding the Pacific Northwest, although Colstrip 4 was kept alive by Los Angeles leasing output from it for 20 or 25 years. So instead of shipping coal on rail cars, we ship it on transmission lines.
No, I understand that our coal is not coming from in the state.
Right.
I was just curious what the footprint, were we getting Wyoming coal shipped to Nevada that we're buying from Nevada, or is that a different pool of coal?
No, the coal gets shipped in Nevada, and then the electricity gets shipped to California.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, I don't think a new coal-fired plant could get sited in California or Washington or Oregon. So we indirectly ship our coal in that electronic form.
Be a possibility, and we have a company that is looking at it, has leased up some deep coal reserves and looked at in situ coal gasification. They haven't really done much of haven't gone too far down the road to make it happen, but we would hope that in the future that would be a viable technology. We've got in Wyoming about 45 billion tons of mineable coal, but we have 1.3 trillion tons of total resource. You reporters know that figures don't lie, but liars figure, and you got to be careful when you start looking at those and know the difference between a reserve and a resource. But the reserves, what we can economically mine, is 45 billion. The resource, total resource, 1.3 trillion. So if we could start figure out how to do in situ coal gasification, we could convert some of those resources over to reserves. And Bureau of Mines tried it in Hanna back in the 70s, never very successfully. But it's a technology that we would hope would take off at some point. But it's not; it's a long ways off.
Yeah, I would just say that I think other people are doing the initial experiments with up in the tar sands area of Alberta and in using coal shale. So we have more of that sort of in on-site gasification liquefaction experiments underway, and I think people are going to ride that out and see how successful that is. But I think in general, that's the direction mining is headed. I think almost all of the uranium mining taking place in the West is being produced that way. There's proposals. Most of the gold mining and production of copper metal is chemical now rather than smelting. So I suspect for better or for worse, that's
mining low grade coal in Alaska, we have higher grade coal here.
Well, you're a lot closer to the Pacific Rim.
Absolutely.
and you've got some operations there. I toured last year the Pebble Project, and they're going to need all kinds of energy if that thing ever goes. And no energy source close by. So if you want to develop some of the areas of Alaska, maybe plants there would make sense versus transmission lines. But I really don't know a whole lot about that particular coal field. But you can always try it, you know. And we've tried that a lot to try to upgrade our coal to dry it. And that's really the only difference in high BTU coal versus low BTU coal is the moisture in it.
To clarify, Marion, were you saying that the new coal mining of low-grade coal in Alaska may be to fuel new gold mining in Alaska?
Copper gold. Yeah, I was just in deposition this week over here.
You need something else to go fight on.
I just wanted to make sure I understood.
I'm already doing that. But the coal mines I've seen are close to the coast, and you know they're going to build a port and just put it on the ship. So I mean it's going to be incredibly cheap transportation compared to on land type transportation. So that's what's been written suggests it's going to be exported to Asia, but that you know that's a mystery down here too, because the conventional wisdom has always been that it's only metallurgical coal that is high enough value that you actually can move it across land, put it on ship, and send it, you know, to Japan or China or somewhere else. But now there's lots of talk about shipping much lower grade coal, and so that's a change, and I haven't seen an economic explanation for it.
I know there are a couple of questions here, but I'm under tremendous pressure to make the trains run on time. We have the afternoon plenary starting at 3:30, lessons from the Gulf. You have 15 minutes, actually getting out maybe 30 seconds early from here, so you'll be able to get the best seats. Please thank our panel before you go. Thank you very much.